This is Audible.
John Wiley and Sons Limited presents Project Management for Dummies by Nick Graham and Stanley E. Portney. Read by Gareth Armstrong. Introduction. Projects have been around since ancient times. Noah building the Ark, Leonardo da Vinci painting the Mona Lisa, Edward Gibbon writing The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, Jonas Salk developing the polio vaccine, all projects. And as you know, these projects are all masterful successes. Well, the products were a spectacular success, even if schedules and resource budgets were sometimes overrun. Why then is the topic of project management of such great interest today? The answer's simple. The audience has changed, and the stakes are higher. Historically, projects were large, complex undertakings. The first project to use modern project management techniques, the development of the Polaris weapon system in the early 1950s, was a technical and administrative nightmare. Teams of specialists planned and tracked the myriad research, development, and production activities. They produced mountains of paper to document the intricate work. As a result, people started to view project management as a highly technical discipline with confusing charts and graphs. They saw it as inordinately time-consuming, specialist-driven, and definitely off-limits for the common man or woman. Because of the ever-growing array of huge, complex, and technically challenging projects in today's world, people who want to devote their careers to planning and managing them are still vital to the project's success. Over the past 25 to 30 years, however, the number of projects in the regular workplace has skyrocketed. Projects of all types and sizes are now the way that organizations accomplish work involving development and change. At the same time, a new breed of project manager has emerged. This new breed may not have set career goals to become project managers. Many among them don't even consider themselves to be project managers, but they do know that they must successfully manage projects to move ahead in their careers. Clearly, project management has become a critical management skill for many, not just a career choice for a few. Even though these project managers realize they need special tools, techniques, and knowledge to handle their new types of assignments, they may not be able to devote large amounts of time to acquiring them, which is where this audiobook comes in. Part 1. Understanding Projects and What You Want to Achieve. Chapter 1. Project Management, the Key to Achieving Results. Running projects well is fast becoming an essential management skill. Many organizations, private and public sector, now recognize that they're losing money and business opportunities unnecessarily because they're failing to plan and control their projects effectively. Companies, charities, and public sector organizations are constantly changing, and ever faster, as they adapt to new market conditions, new financial conditions, new business practices, new legal requirements, and new technology. Running projects often creates the change, and as a result, businesses are increasingly driven to find individuals who can excel in this project-oriented environment. The chances are that you've been asked to manage a project for the first time, or that you're already involved in projects and are looking to see whether you can find easier and better ways of doing things. If the project is indeed your first one, that's a challenge and may well give you the chance to excel in something you haven't done before. For many, managing a project even opens a door to a new career. The really good news here, whether you're completely new or have some experience, is that project management has been around for a very long time. In that time, project managers have come up with highly effective strategies and a range of very practical techniques. By following a sound approach to the project, you automatically avoid many of the pitfalls that continue to contribute to or cause project failure on a mind-boggling scale. You may ask why, if good ways of doing things are out there, people ignore them and then have their projects fail. Good question. People make the same project mistakes repeatedly, and they're largely avoidable. The following list takes a quick look at the main causes of project failure. The list makes for depressing reading, but gives a good background against which to contrast successful project management. Lack of clear objectives. Nobody's really sure what the project is about, much less are people agreed on it. Lack of risk management. Things go wrong that someone could easily have foreseen and then controlled to some degree, or even prevented. No senior management buy-in. Senior managers were never convinced and so never supported the project, leading to problems such as lack of resource. Neither did those managers exercise normal management supervision as they routinely do in their other areas of responsibility. Poor planning. Actually, that's being kind, because often the problem is that no planning was done at all. It's not surprising, then, when things run out of control because nobody knows where the project should be at this point anyway. No clear progress milestones. The lack of milestones means nobody sees when things are off track and problems go unnoticed for a long time. Understated scope. The scope and the project plan are superficial and understate both what the project needs to deliver and the resource needed to deliver it. The additional work that is necessary then takes the project out of control, causing delay to the original schedule and overspending against the original budget. Poor communications. Many projects fail because of communication breakdown, which can stem from unclear roles and responsibilities and from poor senior management attitudes, such as not wanting to hear bad news. Unrealistic resource levels. It just isn't possible to do a project of the required scope with such a small amount of resource, staff, money, or both. Unrealistic timescales. The project just can't deliver by the required time, so it's doomed to failure. No change control. People add in things bit by bit. Scope creep. Then it dawns on everyone that the project's grown so big that it can't be delivered within the fixed budget or by the set deadline. That's 10 reasons for failure. But you can probably think of a few more. The interesting thing about these problems is that avoiding them is, for the most part, actually not that difficult. Before you start to think too deeply about how to set up the project, the first thing to do is check whether it really is one. You can consider three things to decide if a job is a project. Is it a one-off job or something that's ongoing? If the job is ongoing, like taking customer orders, then it's business as usual, not a project. Does the job justify project controls? Project management means incurring some overheads, but some jobs are so small or straightforward that they just don't justify that degree of control. This last one may sound a little weird, and it certainly doesn't fit with the formal definitions. It's the question, do you want to handle the job as a project? You may choose to deal with a block of work as a project, but I wouldn't. Sometimes you have a choice. Projects, large or small, involve the following areas of control. Scope, what the project will deliver. Time, when the project will deliver. Quality, so often forgotten but an essential dimension. Resource, necessary amounts of people, funds and other resources, such as equipment and accommodation, that the project needs. You need to balance these areas for each project, and you can see immediately why so many projects get into difficulties. You look at a project, think about the four control factors and say to yourself, they want that scope to that quality level with just that resource, and by then, they've got to be joking. Strangely, organizational managers often commit projects to failure by insisting on unachievable deadlines or unrealistic resources. What's even stranger is that those same managers are surprised and even angry when the projects inevitably get into difficulties and fail. Although many other considerations may affect a project's performance, these four components are the basis of a project's definition for the following reasons. The only reason a project exists is to produce the results specified in its scope. The project's end date is usually an essential part of defining what constitutes successful performance. The quality requirement is a vital part of the balance and may be the most important element. What's the point of delivering an unusable heap of garbage on time and within budget? The availability of resources can affect which products the project can produce and the timescale in which it can produce them. Quality can be a very important factor and is sometimes the most important, so do think about it carefully. A project to build and install a new air traffic control system for the south of the UK was criticised for being over budget and late on delivery. As a number of people have pointed out, though, if you're sitting in an aeroplane circling while waiting to land at London Heathrow Airport, one of the world's busiest, would you rather that they got the air traffic control system in on time and to budget, or that they'd got it right? Projects come in a wide assortment of shapes and sizes. For example, projects can be large or small. Building a new railway link across London, which will cost around £16 billion and take 7 years to complete, is a project perhaps linked to other projects to form a programme. Preparing the annual report for the department, which may take you 6 days to complete, may also be a project. Projects can involve many people, or just you. Training all 10,000 of your organisation's sales staff worldwide in the working of a new product is a project. Redecorating an office and rearranging the furniture and equipment is also a project. Projects can be defined by a legal contract or by an informal agreement. A signed contract between you and a customer that requires you to build a house defines a project. An informal agreement by the IT department to install a new software package in a business area defines a project. Projects can be business-related or personal. Conducting your organization's 5-yearly strategy review is a project. Preparing for a family wedding is also a project, and a much more pleasant one than the 5-yearly strategy review. Every project passes through 4 stages. 1. Starting the project. This stage involves evaluating the business need for the project, the general approach to performing it, and agreeing to prepare a detailed project plan. Outputs from this stage may include approval to proceed to the next stage, documentation of the need for the project, and rough estimates of time and resources to perform it, and an initial list of people who may be interested in, involved with, or affected by the project. 2. Organizing and preparing. This stage involves developing a plan that specifies the desired results, the work to do, the time, the cost, and other resources required. A plan for how to address key project risks. Outputs from this stage include a project plan, documenting the intended project results and the time, resources, and supporting processes to help create them, along with all the other controls that the project needs, such as for risk management. 3. Carrying out the work. This stage involves performing the planned work, monitoring and controlling performance to ensure adherence to the current plan, and doing the more detailed planning of successive phases as the project continues. Outputs from this stage may include project progress reports, financial reports, and further detailed plans. 4. Closing the project. This stage involves assessing the project results, obtaining approvals, assigning project team members to new work, closing financial accounts, and conducting a post-project evaluation. Outputs from this stage may include final, accepted, and approved project results and recommendations, and suggestions for applying lessons learned from this project to similar efforts in the future. For small projects, this entire life cycle can take a few days. For larger projects, it can take years. In a perfect world, projects run smoothly and always go exactly to plan. However, because you don't live in a perfect world, and because your project certainly won't be running in one, you need to be flexible. When starting to think about your project, you need to allow for the unknown and uncertain. Projects are rarely 100% predictable. The normal territory of projects is that, to some extent at least, you're going into the unknown. Therefore, your plans need to allow for things going off track. You need contingency. Remember Murphy's Law? If it can go wrong, it will go wrong. Despite doing your best to assess feasibility and develop good plans at the front end of the project, you may find later on that you can't achieve what you thought you could, or in the way you thought you could. When this situation happens, you need to rethink in the light of the new information you've acquired. Your initial assessments are sound, and your plan is detailed and realistic. However, certain key project team members leave the organization without warning during the project. Or perhaps the business environment changes, and with it, your organization's whole market strategy. Because ignoring these occurrences may seriously jeopardize your project success, you need to rethink and replan in the light of these new realities. The project manager's job is to manage the project on a day-to-day basis to bring it to a successful conclusion. He'll usually be accountable to a senior manager who's the project sponsor, or to a small group of managers who form a project steering committee or project board. The project manager's job is challenging. For instance, he often coordinates technically specialized professionals who may have limited experience working together to achieve a common goal. It's important to understand that the project manager's position is indeed a role. It's not about status. That's true of all roles in the project, and there may, for example, be very senior people working as team members, such as chief engineers and legal advisors, who are accountable to the project manager, even though in the normal business they're very much his senior. Both team members and the project manager himself must understand that he has responsibility and authority in the project that comes with the role, independent of his organizational grade or rank. The project manager doesn't do any of the technical work of the project in his role as project manager. If he's involved in technical work, it's with a different hat on, that of a team member. The distinction is important because if you're doing teamwork as well as project managing, you must be clear about both roles and only wear one hat at a time. It's all too easy to neglect the management and let the project run out of control because you're so engrossed in the detail and challenges of your part of the technical work. The project manager's role requires hard skills, such as planning and costing, but also soft people skills, and his success requires a keen ability to identify and resolve sensitive organizational and interpersonal issues. Your role as the project manager is one of day-to-day responsibility for the project, and that might involve so much work that your job must necessarily be a full-time one. Or it may be that the project is smaller and less complicated, and project management is just part of your job. Either way, the responsibilities are the same. It's just the scale and complexity that are different. Sketch out initial ideas for the project with a justification, outline costs, and timescales. Plan the project, including mapping out the controls that will be put in place, defining what quality the project needs and how it will be achieved, analyzing risk, and planning control actions. Control the flow of work to teams, or perhaps just team members in a smaller project. Motivate and support teams and team members. Liaise with external suppliers. Liaise with project managers of interfacing projects. Liaise with program management staff if the project is one of a group of projects being coordinated as a program. Ensure that the project deliverables are developed to the right level of quality. Keep track of progress and adjust to correct any minor drifts off the plan. Keep track of spending. Go to others, such as the steering committee, if things go more significantly off track. For example, the whole project is threatened. Report progress, such as to the sponsor or steering committee. Keep track of risks and make sure that control actions are taken. Deal with any problems involving others as necessary. Decide on changes, getting approval from others where you don't have personal authority to make a decision. For example, when changes involve very high cost. Plan successive delivery stages in more detail. Close the project down in an orderly way when everything's done. So, the tasks will keep you very busy, but they will also be very enjoyable if you're a project manager at heart. A key to project success is being proactive. Get out in front of the project and direct where it's going. Don't follow on behind the project being reactive and having to firefight countless problems because you didn't see them coming. The short-term pressures of your job, particularly if you're fitting in project management alongside other work, may tempt you to cut corners and leave things out. That's not the same as adjusting the project management needs to the project, but rather missing stuff out altogether that you really should have done. Resist the temptation to cut corners, because usually doing so comes back and bites you later when you face unnecessary problems and delay in the project. Chapter 2. Thinking through the life of your project. Just about all project management approaches break projects into stages, or you may know them as phases. Starting the project, organizing and preparing the project planning, carrying out the work, closing the project. Of these stages, the third one, carrying out the work, can repeat, so you can have more than one delivery stage. In a small project, you may decide on a single delivery stage, but in most projects, you have several. Some say that the first stage, starting the project, isn't part of the project but is rather preparation beforehand to include things such as checking to make sure that the project really is a project. If you go with the idea of starting the project not actually being part of the project, then the project starts for real with a full planning in the second stage. Breaking the project into stages has many advantages. Take these four, for example. Stages allow everyone to concentrate on one part of the work at a time. They break up the detailed planning into convenient blocks, and you plan each delivery stage in detail just before that stage starts, and using the latest information. It allows the sponsor or steering committee to stay in firm control of resources by authorizing one stage at a time. It provides a clear point when each stage ends, usually called a stage gate, for checking that the project is still in control and remains viable. How many delivery stages should you have? Well, it all depends. The first thing to say about delivery stages is that they're not all the same length. They're not timed units of, say, 1 month long. Rather, delivery stages reflect two main criteria. Blocks of work that are cohesive and where things belong together. Amounts of work that the sponsor or steering committee is willing to authorize at a time. The amount may vary at different points in the project according to, for example, the degree of risk in that part of the project. The end of each stage is marked by a stage gate meeting with a sponsor or steering committee. The gate is a useful control point to take stock and check that the project is on track. Three reasons for having the starting the project stage are: you need to know whether the project is worth doing. Unfortunately, not all ideas are good ideas. Rather than rushing into full planning, having a quick look at the idea makes sense before committing more time and resource to it. You need to get basic information together. You won't find it easy to plan the project if you haven't established, at least in outline, what the project is, what resources available, and any constraints, such as on the delivery date. You're best sketching out the idea for the project and getting agreement before going on to full planning. If you leap straight into full planning to save time, you often discover that disagreement arises when people check the plans, because they have different ideas about the project, even though they're using the same words. The main thing to remember about starting the project is that you need to go fast. A common mistake is confusing starting the project with the next stage of organizing and preparing, which takes a while. It's likely that starting the project will take a couple of days, and it may just be a couple of hours, even for a fairly substantial project. Imagine that you're a rich and successful project manager, and you want a huge house built for you. You go to an architect and say, "I'd like you to build a house for me, please." What does the architect reply? "That's fine. I'll come back to you in 8 weeks with some scale drawings." No. The architect says, "That's fine. Please take a seat and let's talk about what you have in mind, and we'll do a sketch plan." The architect starts with a sketch, not a beautifully finished scale drawing. So it is with starting the project. You do a sketch on the back of an envelope to check whether the project idea is a good one and whether it's worth going on to full planning. In starting the project, you think roughly what the project is and whether it's worth continuing to the next stage to do the full planning. You look at six key areas. 1. Objective. What exactly is the objective of the project? To save money, perhaps, or speed up the ordering procedures. You need to make sure everyone's clear on the objective, has thought it through, and agreed it. 2. Scope. What's the project intended to cover, and usefully, what won't it cover if some areas are unclear? What will the project finally deliver? 3. Resource. How much do you expect the project to cost? Be realistic here. How much staff resource will the project need, and will it need particular skills? The resource figures are very much ballpark ones at the moment, because the planning has yet to be done. 4. Time. How long is the project likely to take, on the assumption that resource can be provided when it's needed? Again, this is a ballpark estimate. 5. Justification. Why do you want to run the project? Perhaps this is a no-brainer because the project is mandatory. Head office has instructed that each regional office runs a project to review its local client base. Normally, though, the project is justified because of benefits such as greater market penetration, lower costs, or faster customer service. 6. Constraints. Will anything influence the way that the project is run, or even what it delivers, and when? For example, it might be time-critical. You should also think about the required quality level of the project, such as whether it's quick and dirty, safety-critical, or usually somewhere in between. Unless you have a very small project for which you can keep the full details in your head, and nobody else needs to read anything about it, you're going to have to write some things down. The trick here is to keep documents to the minimum and to think wide about how you communicate information. Projects seem to attract paper and the electronic equivalent. Keep your project documentation trimmed down, or you'll drive up project costs and push out the delivery date. For the starting the project stage, you need to write down the information you find out in the form of an outline document that others, such as steering committee members, can read and then approve or reject. However, don't get too detailed. Although the information is in a document, you may well discuss the content in a meeting or give a short presentation to the decision-makers and give out the document as a backup. Okay, on with the next stage then. Roll your sleeves up and get down to the real work of project planning. The organization and preparing stage gets you ready for the delivery stages of the project. It covers the overall planning of the project and also the detailed planning of the first delivery stage. If the sponsor or steering committee says go at the end of the organizing and preparing stage, the first delivery stage can start immediately because the detailed plan for it is already in place. When thinking through this stage, balance the work very carefully. A major cause of project failure is poor plans or a complete lack of plans. The answer to that problem isn't to go to the other extreme of developing excessively detailed plans for everything. Overplanning just wastes time now, and then again as the plans are maintained throughout the project. Because things will almost certainly have changed since the start of the project, that maintenance will include reworking the detail, making much of the initial work a waste of time. The approach of developing a high-level project plan now and then more detailed stage plans as you approach each delivery stage gives you good control. As with most work, use the KISS principle for planning. Keep it simple, stupid. Start simple and only get complicated where really necessary in order to exercise sufficient control over the project. For the detailed planning work, you need to investigate a number of areas, and usually that means consulting other people. You may be a subject expert and need little advice, but project managers don't necessarily have to be subject experts and so often need to get input from people who are. Some of the areas will be developed into more detail from the high-level information set down in the project outline. Scope. Now it's time to finalize the scope. Say exactly what the project will cover and deliver, and also, if you identify areas that could otherwise be misunderstood, what it won't cover. Business case. The business case sets out the full justification of the project, including its costs, and also defines the business benefits that the project will deliver and the way in which those benefits will be measured. Project plan. The project plan is a high-level plan of the delivery stages and closure stage, although the closure stage may be particularly tentative at the moment. The project plan sets down what the project will deliver, the activities, and the staff, resource, and finance involved. Risk. You should look at the risk involved in the project and also the means of controlling it. Some people question whether you really need risk management in every project, even the very small ones. Yes, you do. Quality. In the project outline, you've already indicated the quality level needed for this project. Now is the time to establish exactly how you'll carry the quality through into the deliverables, what degree of control you need to exercise, and how you'll audit to make sure that the required quality is being delivered. Roles and responsibilities. Who needs to do what in the project? You probably decided this back in the first stage, but it's worth setting down roles and responsibilities now with any adjustments. In that way, everyone involved knows what they should be doing on the project, and importantly, what everyone else should be doing as well. That helps avoid communications problems where things fall down the gaps. Communications. You need to think through the communications carefully, because this area is a major cause of project failure. Controls. For a very small project, don't get carried away, because you probably won't need many controls at all. In a larger project, though, you need to think through controls carefully. You should document all planning and control areas, albeit simply, on small projects. On larger projects, expect the documentation to be more substantial. Remember the balance of having sufficient information to define and control the project, but not more than that. The name given to the main planning document in the organizing and preparing stage is often Project Charter, but other terms are in use that you might recognize, such as Project Plans, Project Definition Document, PDD, or Project Initiation Document, PID. The Project Charter is used to define the project and say how it will be controlled. The charter will also form an information base for a decision on whether to run the project, then as an ongoing reference for those coming into the project later on. Along with a charter, you also need the stage plan for the first delivery stage so you can proceed without undue delay. This is the stage that usually repeats. You can have multiple delivery stages. It is simple in concept, as its title suggests. The delivery stage is where the teams build project products and test them, so it's the main part of the project. In a delivery stage, you give work out to teams, get progress information back in, and keep track of where the stage is. If the stage is going off the plan, you need to establish why that is and take action to get it back on track. That adjustment is part of the routine steering that you need to do throughout. If things go off track by more than an amount set by the sponsor or steering committee, then you need to refer the matter back for discussion and a decision. You also need to make allowances for unplanned stuff. You must allow time, and perhaps the time of other people, to deal with things such as problem resolution and changes. Towards the end of each delivery stage, you'll need to do the more detailed planning for the following stage and update the project charter as necessary. During the stages, you produce regular progress information for the sponsor or steering committee, and towards the end of each stage, you also produce a stage plan for the next stage. It's important for a number of people, both inside and outside the project, to be kept up to date on the project's progress. The communications management plan can include quite a list of people who need to get a copy of progress reports, such as organizational managers and managers of other projects. Depending on what the sponsor or steering committee wanted, and on how formal the project is, you may need to produce a report at the end of the stage to record how it went and what the final figures are on cost and time. Closing the project. Normally, you have work to do to close down the project and release resource, and on the technical side, to deal with any teething problems and adjustments. In the project plan, prepared at the start of the project, the closure work is uncertain, and so the plan is tentative. As you approach the end of the final delivery stage, everything is clear, and you can plan closure with confidence. In closure, you need to evaluate the work required to sort out any teething problems, and then wind down the work and hand over to operational support. You may have already agreed some of the handover, and it may be subject to legal arrangements, such as when handing over a new building. On the project management side, you need to produce documentation needed now and for the future, such as for maintenance, and store it. Finally, you produce a project report to give final costs and the level of any business benefits that you can already see and measure at the end of the project. You need to break the documentation down into two groups: information to be kept about the project itself, and information to be sent to others for action. Project information. A project report and operational documentation, such as that needed for maintenance. Outbound information. Ongoing work, such as risk management needs, as well as information such as lessons learned in this project, which may benefit future ones. A project charter. Some of the areas in the project charter develop those you sketched out in the project outline, and others are new. In all cases, though, adjust the content of the charter to meet the needs of the project. Excessively big charters aren't impressive, they just make work for everyone. Inadequate charters don't define the project or its controls sufficiently well to run the project. Objectives. The agreed objectives for the project. Scope. What's included in the project and what's excluded where confusion may exist. Business case. The justification of why the project is being run, together with a list of benefits and how benefits will be measured. Roles and responsibilities. Who's doing what in this project? This section can also list the stakeholders, those with an interest in the project. Communications management plan. What information will be moving about and how it will be communicated, including reports within the project, which may be verbal. Quality plan. The level of quality that's needed, how the project will achieve the quality, and how the project will be audited to be sure that the quality has indeed been achieved. Risk plan. How risk will be controlled in the project and who's responsible for it. Project plan. Information on what will be produced, the activities needed, and the required resource, notably in terms of finance and staff time. Control procedures. In anything other than a small project, people need a clear statement of procedures, such as for problem reporting. This section also can set down the project manager's authority limits and the procedures for referring anything beyond the project manager. Constraints. Anything that affects how the project is run and delivered, such as security, a fixed delivery date for the project, or limitation on the type of equipment used. Chapter 3. Defining the project and producing a business case. All projects are created for a reason. You identify a need and devise a project to address that need. You then determine the success or failure of the project by how well it meets that need and whether it delivers the business benefit that justified expending all the effort on the project in the first place. This chapter helps you develop clear boundaries for the project, the scope, and then set down the justification or business case for running the project. The scope and business case go hand in hand. Each affects the other, so thinking about them together is helpful. The business case lists the business benefits of running the project. It may be worth adjusting the scope in order to get better business benefits. Equally, it may be advantageous to chop another part of the project out because it isn't absolutely necessary, and very few benefits exist in that part to offset the work involved. It just isn't worth it. The scope, then, is the what, and the business case is the justification, the why. Although you may need to adjust the degree of formality from project to project, you shouldn't ever leave out the work of defining the scope and justifying the work. You always need to be clear about what you're covering in the project, and you should always be very clear about why you want to do that work. Well, unless you're intent on wasting your effort and that of other people, and then delivering the wrong thing as a crowning glory. For the business case in particular, you sometimes need to be more formal than at other times, but you always need to write things down in an ordered way if someone other than you has to approve the project. You may have to work to a set format if you have to go through some organizational approval process, such as getting the go-ahead from a finance committee. The scope statement is a written statement that sets down exactly what the project will cover and usually also what it won't. Both the people who requested the project and those managing it, including the sponsor or steering committee, should agree to the scope statement before any work begins in the delivery stage. Although obviously stating clearly what the project will cover is important, additionally setting down what it won't, negative scope, is often really helpful. The negative scope isn't the whole world outside the intended project, but rather things that people involved in the project could confuse. Misunderstanding the scope when agreeing it is so very easy, and this isn't necessarily because the scope statement is imprecise or careless. Rather, misunderstanding comes from the age-old problem of people seeing what they expect to see, even if it isn't there, and making unconscious assumptions. Even worse is when busy managers sign off the scope statement, having only skim-read the headings while grabbing some water from the cooler between meetings. What's that? Oh no, not in your organisation, of course. Your managers are always very thorough and read important documents with great care. But in other companies. At the end of the project, a common problem is that people look at the deliverable, such as a new computer system for accounting, and a conversation develops with a development team along these lines. I can't see the invoicing function on the main menu. The system doesn't do invoicing. We never set out to include invoicing. What? You can't have an account system without invoicing. Well, actually you can. This is one. But we need invoicing. Look, Here's the scope statement from the project charter, listing all the functions we were going to include, and here's your signature on the bottom where you signed the statement off to agree it. And it doesn't mention invoicing, does it? Oh, no, you're right. It doesn't. But we need invoicing. How simple would it have been to say in the scope statement, right at the beginning of the starting the project stage, that the planned system will include this, this and this, but exclude that, that, and invoicing? Defining the scope properly is about managing expectations. People are clear about what they'll be getting when the project is delivered, but are also clear on what they won't be getting. The negative scope could well lead to a challenge. Continuing with the invoicing example from the last section, if the scope says that the new account system won't include invoicing, this may then be challenged by those asking for the system, who say that actually they need it included. Indeed, if time and funds are limited, they say they'd rather have invoicing than a couple of the other functions listed. That leads to a change of scope, and the project will be all the better for it. You're better off discussing and changing the scope when developing the project charter than in the depths of the project when it slowly starts to dawn on those receiving the project deliverables that they aren't getting quite what they wanted. Better still, however, is discussing the scope when producing a project outline in the starting the project stage. When you discuss and adjust the project boundary while the plan is still a sketch, making changes requires relatively little work. Clearly, though, making changes after you're into more detailed planning is a much bigger job. Grasping the extent of scope. A dictionary definition of scope is the extent of the area or subject matter that something deals with. In your case, the something is the project. So, what's the extent of your project? You can define the scope in one or more of the following ways. Deliverables or products. In many projects, setting down scope in terms of what the project will deliver is helpful. Yes, the end product, but also any significant products along the way. Functions. This is useful for new or revised systems, whether they're computer ones or procedural ones. Which functions will the project cover and which won't it cover? Geography. Which areas of the organisation will the project cover? For example, just your offices in Scotland or just three departments at your corporate headquarters? Time. A more unusual scope definition, but valid and helpful for some projects. The project will cover all work on this subject area between now, when nothing's been done, up to the end of the financial year, when the project must deliver a management review document. When thinking through the dimensions of scope and writing it all down, think about who'll be reading the scope statement in order to approve it. It's no good filling the scope statement with all sorts of technical detail if it must be agreed by people in the business area who don't understand such things. The scope must communicate and must do so particularly to the sponsor or steering committee. They must be able to sign off the scope statement to say, yes, that's the project we want and that's what we're willing to pay for. On the other hand, the scope statement must be specific, so don't shy away from detail where you need to spell things out. If that does include some technical stuff, then put in a plain language explanation. Put simply, if you're asking people to sign off on a scope statement, make sure it's one they can understand and so confirm. It's in nobody's best interests, including yours, for sponsors to sign off documents that they don't understand and are having to take on trust. When you first think about the scope of the project and talk about it with others, you often find that not everything is essential. In your new car project, wheels are pretty important, but lights on the mirrors on the sun visors, while nice, probably aren't essential. It can be a real help, then, to prioritise the requirements. Some use the Moscow approach to help with prioritising. Must have. The essentials. The project must address all these elements. Should have. High priority, but not absolutely essential. Could have. Useful and worthwhile, but lower priority. Won't have. Something suggested, but now not considered worthwhile, or that will be held over, perhaps, for a later enhancement project. Having got the scope clear, although you may go back and adjust it, it's time to look at the justification for the project, why your organisation should do the project. This is the business case. You can adjust the contents of the business case to suit the project and also any organizational standard or methodology you're using. Here are the basic contents that you'll need as a minimum for any project. Benefits. Information on the benefits, but usually also when they'll come on stream, when they'll be measured, by whom, and how. Context. For example, the fit with the organizational 5-year strategy, or just to say it's a small standalone project to improve performance in a particular area of the business. Cost. Ballpark at first, but kept up to date as better information comes to hand. Justification. Is the project solely benefits-driven, or does it have any element of compliance, such as there being a legal requirement to run the project? Time scale. A rough estimate at first, but then updated from better information later. The business case is one of the most important documents you'll have in your project. It shows the justification for doing the project in the first place, but it's then important when monitoring ongoing viability. If, for example, partway through the project, circumstances change and the benefits projections now fall through the floor, you probably want to shut the project down. It follows that you're going to have to keep the business case up to date throughout the project if it's to remain helpful in monitoring the viability of the project and as an aid to decision-making. Keep a copy of the business case when it's approved at the start of the project and again at every approval point, such as a stage gate. But keep the business case up to date and so immediately usable to help check the impact of changes to the project and changes in the environment in which the project is running. When you take on a project, you may need to go and talk to a few people and look in a few places to help you get the justification clear. For example, find out who had the original idea that led to your project and talk to them. Also, go and talk to the end users of the project deliverables, as they can normally help assess the benefits. Then, you may also find information in documents, such as correspondence and emails referring to the project, minutes from division, department and organization-wide planning and budget sessions, reports of planning or feasibility studies. Although they may not have initiated the idea, other people may benefit from your completed project. They may also be able to contribute information to help with the business case. Think about people including business partners, clients, suppliers, and operational staff. Identify these other people as soon as possible to determine what their particular needs and interests are and how you may need to address them. As you identify and note down people who can benefit from your project, you can also note down those who'll oppose it. This helps with your stakeholder analysis. There's a tendency for senior managers to think that all projects must have business benefits to be viable. That's not right thinking, though, and other perfectly valid reasons exist for justifying projects. Having said that, business benefit is the most common justification. Justifications may include 1. Business benefits. Things such as cost savings, better customer service, improved profits, better market penetration. 2. Compliance. Relates to projects that are compulsory even if they bring no business benefits. This includes legal and organizational compliance. 3. Enabling. The project doesn't provide any business benefit in the normal sense, but does something that allows other projects to run, and those projects will deliver business benefit. You can, and often do, have a hybrid business case that has more than one type of justification. For example, your organization may have to run a project for legal compliance, but the project will nevertheless deliver some business benefits. Although those benefits won't completely pay for the project, they'll at least offset some of the costs. Within the justification, it's important to appreciate the differences between 3 types of benefits. 1. Direct saving. A direct saving is where the organization will save real money. If you change an old machine for a new one, the maintenance costs of the new one will be substantially less. The saved money will be in the maintenance budget, and it's real. You're going to get that cash saving. 2. Quantifiable benefit. This is a saving that you can measure in money terms, so it's quantifiable. However, you probably won't see the actual money. For example, a new procedure that will reduce sales admin means that salespeople will save an hour a day. It's unlikely that the sales force will be reduced, it's just that they have an hour more each day to be doing what you employ them to do. Sell. and that's a benefit that you can express in money terms. 3. Non-quantifiable benefit. As the name suggests, you can't express this benefit in money terms, at least not meaningfully. The benefit may be very worthwhile, though. An example is staff working conditions. If the project improves the factory or office environment, then that's worthwhile. But what's it worth in money terms? Can you prove that people who may otherwise have left will now stay, for example? Sometimes you can measure a part of this, such as productivity, but it's a tricky area, and generally you accept the benefit as important but non-quantifiable. Don't ignore non-quantifiable benefits. Things like quality improvements can be hard or impossible to quantify, but they may be extremely important. Now for a warning in the other direction. Be careful with non-quantifiable benefits and try hard to be realistic about them. Because you can never prove them, you need to be all the more careful that you're not fooling yourself about the existence and significance of non-quantifiable benefits. A well-established accounting principle is that of being prudent. Being cautious and erring on the safe side is a well-known trait of most accountants and the source of a lot of accountant jokes. You do well to follow the accountant's example when considering project benefits, though. Two very strong reasons exist to err on the safe side and, if anything, slightly understate the benefits rather than overstate them. Perceptions of success and failure. If your project delivers slightly more benefit than projected, everyone will think it's a particular success. If the project delivers less than projected, then people may see even a great project as a failure. Incorrect strategy decisions. If you overstate the benefits, the project may be run when it shouldn't be. That will have a double impact. The first is that the project won't be the good investment everyone thought it would be. Second, it may well mean that the organization didn't run or delayed another project that would have delivered worthwhile benefit. Benefits realization is one of those terms that's caught on as management speak, and it's the one to use at important meetings to make it sound like you're at the very forefront of current management thinking. However, like many, but not quite all, management catchphrases, some value is tucked away inside the phrase. Put simply, benefits realization is saying when you're going to see the benefits and how you're going to measure the benefits that you can quantify to demonstrate that they were forthcoming. A common misunderstanding is that you see benefits only after the end of the project. In fact, you can see benefits at three places in the process, and you need to put plans in place to measure and report benefits at those points. 1. During the project. In some projects, particularly but not solely business projects, deliverables are taken into operational use right through the project, and there isn't just one big delivery at the end. If things are being taken into operational use during the project, it's likely that you'll start to see benefits during the project too. You can and should measure these benefits and report them straight away to give confidence that the project is on track to deliver the benefits that justified running it. 2. At the end of the project. You may see some benefits at the end of the project after the final delivery. For example, as soon as you commission a new machine at the end of a project, an immediate drop in maintenance costs follows over an old machine that needed daily attention. 3. After the end of the project. Where you introduce something new, it's often the case that it takes a while for everything to settle down so that you can make an accurate measurement of the benefits. For example, with a new business procedure, staff work more slowly than usual when it's first introduced, because they're still learning the procedure and it's unfamiliar. After a few weeks, performance picks up to what's now a normal level, so you can accurately measure and report the cost savings over the old procedure. You can include your plans for measuring benefits in the business case itself, or particularly in larger projects where benefits realization is often more complex, in a separate plan. Benefits contamination is a term coined by Inspirandum when giving guidance on benefits realization and, in particular, deciding how the benefits should be measured. The danger is that benefits are claimed for the project which are really due to something else. If you weren't quite the good project manager that you are, you might have been tempted to think that extra benefits are quite good and will make your project seem better. However, being both intelligent and thoroughly professional, you'll be quick to realize that such contamination is dangerous. It means that measures of what the project has actually achieved are inaccurate. Worse still, contamination may lead to the organization running more similar projects on the assumption